Hello, and welcome to the Book Spider Podcast, a Book of the Week format podcast that strives for rigorous literary analysis and occasionally succeeds. This week we're talking about the novel Perfection by Vincenzo Letronico. Perfection was the first work of Letronico's to be translated into English and published outside of his native market. And it was originally written, I believe, in Italian. And Perfection follows Tom and Anna, who are an expatriate couple from an unnamed European country who are living in an attractive apartment in Berlin. And the opening of the novel introduces their apartment, whose photogenic appeal is inevitably diminished by the messy business of real life. And then proceeds, I think, less as a series of events in a way than a series of themes, right? Each chapter discussing a different aspect of their life as expatriates living in Berlin and the ways in which that aspect of life eventually fails them. So we learn that Tom and Anna are blind to the presence of history and how it actually affects the city around them. We learn that they feel vaguely dissatisfied with monogamous sex, but are put off really by any alternative to it. We learn that they live in a constant state of mediated distraction. We learn that they are unable to find a productive application of their skill set when a humanitarian crisis occurs. As their dissatisfaction is gradually revealed through the examination of these various themes, we see them eventually attempt to transition from gig economy workers to business owners and fail as gentrification slowly erases opportunities for the Berlin expat culture. Eventually, they sublet their apartment and travel to Lisbon and then Sicily in the unsuccessful pursuit of some kind of pleasant and interesting place to live that hasn't been cut off by the impingement of wealth. But they find those places to be provincial and ugly and ultimately miserable and unfulfilling. Then as a stroke of luck, they inherit a property, which they turn into a bed and breakfast. They serve their first run of guests in the summer of 2019 in an uncertain mingling of satisfaction and misery. And Perfection, like I already noted, was the first work of Letronico's to be translated and has kind of become a little bit of a I don't have statistics handy, but it's become the kind of book where, you know, when you buy it at the bookstore, the clerk says, "Oh, cool, I liked that one," right? It's acquired a certain kind of word of mouth among the sorts of people who make word of mouth recommendations about new literary fiction. So we're a little bit behind here. Last year was kind of the year of Perfection, but I wanted to approach it and just kind of talk about, you know, what it's saying and why it has had this unexpected impact in the English language world relative to being the first translated work by a previously very obscure author. So I guess the question I would start with is, and maybe this is like the big question of the book, right? But, you know, this is about two people who experience a long, slow sense of creeping dissatisfaction in a life that is, at least initially, ostensibly very appealing, right? And something probably a lot of the readers who have idolized this book would dream about. So what is their basic mistake? What's the tragic flaw that keeps them from achieving happiness and fulfillment? Or if we were them, what would we do differently?
They didn't take any SSRIs.
They overlooked one of the key opportunities for personal satisfaction.
Yeah, exactly. That's flippant, obviously, but isn't... I read a couple articles about this, one of which kind of described it as a murder mystery, quote-unquote, where what we're trying to figure out is why they're not happy, what happened to their happiness, you know, what... And I don't know, it doesn't seem that mysterious. I mean, we could answer this on a couple different levels, right? So, you know, living digitally is notoriously bad for your mental health, right? Like, we know this. This is well-founded and researched. You know, the more you pay attention to the social media, the more you try to live this kind of digital existence, typically the unhappier you are, because you find yourself, comparing yourself to others. There's fear of missing out. There's all this stuff. So on that level, that seems like totally blatant why they are not happy, right? You know, you can't strive to live in a digital world without being unhappy. And, you know, the tragedy of it is that, everything operates digitally these days, right? Like, you know,
they have no choice ultimately.
Right.
At least within the career where they've ended up somewhat contingently, right? Like, they've happened to end up in this career path where they have to live in a digital world, but that is, as you've noted, profoundly dissatisfying.
And yeah, I mean, there are still like lifestyles where you can pay less attention to digital stuff and be less engaged digitally, you know, blue collar work where you don't sit at a desk and, you know, have to engage with social media as part of your job, or create a website or do website stuff. So there are still some type lifestyles, but you know, they, as you noted, Hans, they're not part of it. And they, you know, they can't, unless they like re-educate themselves to go into some blue collar field, then they're not going to be able to do that. Then there's another level where, life just kind of gets more dissatisfactory as you grow older.
Exactly.
Like,
and they haven't done anything to prepare themselves by laying the groundwork for something with greater meaning.
Right. Like, you just, like, as you get older, less and less of what you hoped for yourself mm-hmm. becomes realized. And that's just like a fact of life. There's like almost there's a small minority of people whose dreams come true, a teeny tiny less than a percentage of people whose dreams come true exactly as they wanted them. And
most of those people ultimately end up pretty miserable, right?
Right.
Kurt Cobain had all his dreams come true in exactly the way that he hoped for, and I think was probably ultimately less happy than if he had just worked in a grocery store and played clubs at night. You know?
Right. And like the same is probably true of someone like Elon Musk, who is a, he's an awful human being, and he, you know, there's some indication that he constantly feels the need to like prove himself in some way or another, like as a gamer or as a genius or as a, you know, a thought innovator, and you know, which isn't to say that he probably lives in an extremely exciting life, but that doesn't necessarily translate to internal happiness or satisfaction.
Doesn't seem so.
So, yeah, I mean, like, I enjoyed this novel as, like, a depiction of the hollowness of modern life and the hollowness of digital, you know, living digitally. But if you go back 600 years to feudal Japan, which is super different, you still have, you know, the average person who shovels shit in the street or whatever, or you know, is like a service to some lord, is probably just as dissatisfied and unhappy.
Yeah,
I think going back to the digital life, the fact that we live our lives digitally, And that so much of this book is about how the two characters sort of live through their online presence. It's their professional. They have a physical presence in Berlin, but Letronico makes a point of sort of making clear that they don't really explore like the geography of place of belonging to a place. It's more it's a little more narrow than that. What draws them to Berlin, and I totally agree that like this is getting at that sort of fundamental dissatisfaction of online living. And I would actually go a little further. I think something popped into my head while reading this book, and that was this idea that I've maybe even talked about on this podcast before, that fundamentalism, religious fundamentalism, didn't predate Darwin, right? So like before Darwin, there was geologists who were saying that the world was older than 6,000 years. But basically in that century, religion was pressed into a new shape to respond to the ideas of the different ideas that could explain the world. And that's a bit of a non sequitur, but it might make sense if I say that I wonder if authenticity and living an authentic life, did that exist in the same way before the internet?
The need for authenticity?
Well, the idea of living an authentic life, right? So like right now we have images and stories of, you know, living in Berlin and belonging to a particular clique, or being an expat, or, you know, renting an apartment that overlooks a bay, you know, and you're walking to, you know, little markets that are peopled the people who are working in those markets and have worked in those markets, you have no relationship to them because you have no relationship to this place. And it seems that that authenticity is an image of belonging that is legible in a social media sense, right? So like authenticity is like this, it's like a fungible asset of belonging that you feel like you can purchase by like sort of trying to, you know, I don't even necessarily know, but like it's something that they're seeking. But actually, I don't know if authenticity is something that really speaks to what it's trying to represent. Like it's almost a trap, right? Like you try to live an authentic life and just by making an effort down that false path, you doom yourself to not live an authentic life. And it makes me wonder about like this really insidious fundamental layer to the, you know, sort of digital nomad lifestyle, that, you know, there is, I think, this sincere desire to belong and to connect and to explore and to experience that is mediated through an abstraction, a fundamental abstraction that does not actually connect to the real world. And I think that they're just stuck there. You know, they never realize that this is, you know, the thing that they're buying into, a false narrative, for connecting and being in the world.
They're stuck in a world of surfaces. Their interest is in displaying a... Their interest is in creating and displaying a surface-level presentation of an authentic life. And they don't understand that that is ultimately, in a very fundamental way, different from living an authentic life. Now, can one live an authentic life? What does it take to live an authentic life? Does the racking oneself over authenticity, is that ultimately kind of a hell loop that is an inescapable hell loop that will never lead to actual authenticity? That's hard to say, right? But it seems as though they never really even quite get to the level of considering those questions, really. And when they, like the Lisbon and Sicily scenes, right? Like, in some sense, that is them. The issue with those communities, perhaps, is not so much their, you know, I mean, maybe they're cold, maybe they're wet, maybe people are unfriendly there, but ultimately those are not places that are well adapted to displays of authentic, displays of authentic life. They're not display-oriented places in the same ways that the other places they've traveled and enjoy might be. I agree with you, Patrick. I mean, your point, you mentioned the review that said that this was kind of the mystery of why they're not happy. And if anything, it seems maybe there's layers or complications that I'm not acknowledging based on just a first read. But it seems to me like it's actually pretty straightforward why they're not happy. And the novel, I think, says unusually explicitly for, you know, literary fiction why they're not happy, right? It's not, I don't think it's necessarily a conceptually sophisticated novel. Now, it's not like, and I don't mean that in a critical way, right? I think, you know, from the bit that I knew about it before I started reading it, I was thinking, you know, is there's, you have a novel about two people who are persistently unhappy, worse so as time goes by, right? And that could be about, there are fundamentally two ways that could go, right? In one way, that could be about how a critique of a specific life and time and place where, like, it's about why their life makes them unhappy, right? Or alternately, it could be about the fundamentally inexplicable ways in which all life ultimately makes most people unhappy, right? In the absence of, you know, certain factors we might use to push back against that, and maybe not even then, right? I mean, I think, like, I don't know, like, all of the people, all three hosts of this podcast, I think, have kind of made, like, a secular religion out of the arts in a way, right? And that's definitely kept us from being as disconnected and miserable as we would have been without it, but ultimately probably has not been a source of that great a satisfaction in the scheme of things, right? Like, I mean, I would say that's given me about a 6 out of 10 satisfaction relative to, you know, what I would have had without it. Maybe Tom and Anna have, like, by the time the novel's over, like a 2 or 3 out of 10, right? But it's something like this can, my point that I just digressed from a bit, right? That something like this could either be a critique of their particular life, or it could be kind of about the challenge, the very elusive challenge of fulfillment in any kind of, you know, human existence that's above the level of basic subsistence. And it kind of is both in a way, right? But it is ultimately, I mean, I think the critique of a particular kind of 21st century surface-oriented life is, I think, pretty clear and not particularly subtle or difficult to figure out.
I was going to, like, the way you just phrased that, Hans, you said, you know, this is a critique of the surface-oriented digital life that 21st century human beings kind of face. I think that's pretty succinct, pretty precise. I do wonder, like, that section where they're trying to help out with the humanitarian crisis by offering design, I think if I remember, it's for a website to raise money or raise donations or something like that. And
yeah, don't they make like a pamphlet of common Arabic? They make like an Arabic phrase book, and then everybody just uses their Google Translate instead.
Yeah, their phones. And I wonder, like, so that tells me that they're not, like, it's not like they are shallow people, right? Like, it's not necessarily that they are, that they're amoral or shallow or they don't care. You know, a person who really didn't care would not try to do anything about this humanitarian crisis. So, like, does that complicate things? Does that, how does that fit with the novel's critique?
I think that's right, Patrick. That's a good line of inquiry. And I just add the, they do attempt to do something again with the large project they have with the hotel. You know, they're basically working constantly. They're giving themselves to this project. It's not driven by, you know, it's not quite as morally compelling as that.
But an emphasis on craft and doing a good job.
Yeah, yeah, and they're not you know they're not lazy, I guess, right? They have a goal and they are trying to do something. So this isn't a story about, I think, just sort of to add another detail to what you were saying, Patrick, this isn't a story about people who are coasting in dissatisfaction. They're trying, you know, and but so like, does that mean, and maybe this goes back to your question, Hans, like whether this is a story about a fault in the world or a fault in them, you know, is their failure a result of something they lack, or is it a result of something that is wrong in their environment that they, or are they just unlucky? I don't think that they're just unlucky. That's not what the story's about. So
they're quite lucky.
They're quite lucky. Yes, exactly.
In a way, that's part of their problem, right? Is they have these certain isolated pockets of great luck, which then create these kind of situations that become traps in a way, you know? The apartment is a trap. Hmm. It's a trap disguised as great luck. The bed and breakfast is a trap disguised as a stroke of great luck. I think that the narrator even says when they inherit the place they turn into the bed and breakfast that it seems like luck, but actually is not. Although I think at the time I was a little uncertain how to read that. If that was luck in the sense of randomness, or luck in the sense of good things happening through randomness. But still, I mean, they're not unlucky, and in a way, perhaps like their moments of luck actually create these little kind of pits of it like any kind of, and this is something that I've observed in my own life, you know, there are certain situations you get into that are unlikely in their goodness that then become stifling in a weird way, right? Because like you're not going to have that same luck again, you know?
So they're not unlucky, they're not lazy, they're not feckless. And they're not.
I mean, they might be feckless.
They might, yeah, they might be a little feckless.
It's, you know, thinking about like the refugee crisis, right? Why do they become interested? It's not like there've never been needy people in the world before that, right? Or suffering people, right? They become interested because it's in the media. There are striking images in the media of these people being of these people suffering, and they make a short, shallow attempt at helping.
Oh, so they are shallow.
Well, you could argue, right? I mean, because like humanitarian work is hard.
Right.
You know, it's hard and it takes dedication and persistence and often sucks, you know, and doesn't always help. And it's not something that you can just luck into the way you luck into a nice apartment in Berlin, you know. And so, I mean, I think like that particular thing, it's a situation where they're, even though in some ways they are not, they are not, as you say, Chris, they're not entirely feckless, they're not entirely shallow, they're not entirely bad-hearted, there's still a certain kind of the life that they've had and the things they have valued and prioritized have not prepared them to meet that moment in a meaningful way. Partly because the simple fact that they're trying to meet that moment in that way is a symptom in itself, right?
Yeah, it strikes me that they're never open to being remade by the situation that they put themselves in or find themselves in. You know, they're unhappy in Lisbon, and rather than commit through that unhappiness and find themselves changed on the other side, they, you know, they retreat. The pamphlets don't work and they retreat, you know, and it's rather than finding a new way to contribute that would force them to reflect the space and the people with which they want to connect, they retreat.
And I mean, at the time that they retreat, the refugee crisis is fading from the headlines, right? It is no longer presented in images. Going back to the theme of images, I guess with anything that's a critique, you always, ideally, you want there to be a better option presented, right? Is there? What is the choice that they could be making or the thing they could be doing that would lead them to fulfillment? I mean, I guess to some extent, like, there's a subtle implication that the answer is, like, go back to where you came from, have a more conventional career and a couple kids. But I don't want that to be the answer, and that probably is an oversimplification, right? Like, I don't think that, like, moving back to your hometown and settling down, the people I know who've done that, I don't think, I mean, there's, it might be something you have to do as an admission of defeat, but I don't think it necessarily is something that's going to make you any more satisfied than these people are.
That seems like a morally neutral choice that I hope the novel is not, like, explicitly endorsing. Like, you need to return to your roots and whatever, you know, that would.
Maybe the answer is just that they've been, by the time that they have the crisis, it's too late to solve the crisis because for so long they've been derelict in doing the things that would better set them up to handle it, right? Like there's the paragraph I thought was really interesting about the ways that they totally overlook and misunderstand the role that history has in the construction of the city, right? Or the empty lot that used to be an airport that they just kind of like in this vague aesthetic sort of way. Maybe by the time that they truly have a crisis, the crisis is insoluble because it comes from years of small oversights like that accreting.
But also, you know, the lack of a explicit alternative might come from the fact that what is like a real alternative to the digital life, basically. As we just said, you know, like we hope the novel isn't endorsing, like, go back to where you come from, settle down, have kids, get a conventional job. Hopefully that's not the alternative. But even, like you said, Hans, even doing that doesn't secure happiness. Nor to go maybe further or to characterize it in another way, it doesn't really extricate you from the systems that make the modern world what it is. Like, even if you stay at home, stay in the place that you were born or stay close to it, have children, get a conventional job, that's still will typically support the economic, social, socioeconomic systems that modern human beings live in, you know?
Right.
So, like, an alternative is to become, like, a self-subsisting hermit on public lands or something, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think, like, to the extent that anything we've talked about is an alternative, it's a very difficult and rare alternative, right? Like, finding fulfillment through humanitarian work is very, very few people do that, you know?
Right. Like, there might be, like, Greta Thunberg, who, you know, she's famous.
Right, right. Who probably is actually, like, not a particularly happy person, I don't suspect, you know? So, like, I don't know that, well, I don't know. I don't know. I am so, like, chronically dissatisfied at this stage of my life.
Yeah, Hans, what should they do? Hans, tell us what people should do to be happy.
There is no, they can't do anything.
Much has been said in one form or another about, in any kind of art, how much easier it is to credibly depict problems than to propose solutions, right? And it's not necessarily, I suppose, to the detriment of the novel that we don't really have any clear idea of what they could do to achieve fulfillment, right? It doesn't seem like they're going to be fulfilled by running this business. Totally aside from the fact that it's happening in, you know, summer of 2019. So they're fucked anyway, right? I guess that does suggest that maybe they are thinking about the future of the characters. It suggests that they really will have to truly confront these problems, right? That this thing that they have lucked into, that is kind of this, if nothing else, this thing they can do, right? And this place where they can continue to have the same value system of working toward internet-based shallow representations of contentment, that is going to be probably taken away from them. And so they will have to face these questions in a much more severe, sustained way, or, you know, die, I suppose.
It seems like, I'm trying, I can't name them all, but Patricia Lockwood's novel, No One Is Talking About This. I just was reading Cosmopolis, and for some reason, Eric Packard's arc felt a little bit comparable in a different kind of way, commenting on a different sort of imprisoning system, but related. It seems like all of the stories that pop into mind don't necessarily propose solutions so much as show the ending of something, or show like something like piercing and utterly destroying the character's ability to maintain. Like, there's not like a, they're not, people don't leave these systems. They're like forced out of them by tragedy, by death, by, you know, pandemic, by the system itself, like shuddering to a stop. I'm trying to think of any other examples. My mind is blank, but the, you know, I don't know. I certainly wouldn't know how to advise Latronico to propose a solution to this issue, because it's so omnipresent, and I don't know what is outside of the system to even sort of like propose that solution. And so, like, you have these other stories that are, you know, at least for me right now, feel like they're kind of sort of gesturing at the same sort of modern malaise and feelings of entrapment in a meaningless existence. And it does feel like the story veers toward some tragic event that is enough to break them out of it.
What is, and thinking of any period that we want, right? What is the best literary novel? And leaving aside, of course, the many problems with that categorization, but just based on like generally accepted categorizations, what is the best literary novel about a person finding contentment and satisfaction and starting from a point of misery or dissatisfaction or frustration or, you know, the kind of spirit that Tom and Anne are in here, starting from a position like that and actually finding the answer that brings them a rewarding life? Eat, Pray, Love.
There's actually, I don't know if it's the best, but it's the first one that came to mind. And Chris and I actually did either a video or an episode about it before, like, the podcast took on its current shape, and it's called Of Human Bondage by William Somerset Maugham. And basically the character, it's like a Bildungsroman of a character who, like, goes through, you know, a deeply passionate but ultimately you know, controversial or unsatisfying or nasty relationship, and he, you know, he's very unhappy, super duper depressed, and at the end of the novel he, like, finds a calling as a veterinarian or a doctor in some kind of English town, and, like, learns to kind of settle down and be, to be, I think like the ultimate idea with the novel is that, like, Of Human Bondage refers to our passions. So, you know, needing to be, less passionate, more reasonable, more intellectual, is where the novel goes. So that's maybe an example. I certainly don't know if it's the best. I remember thinking it was all right, but not like a masterpiece. And the conceit behind the episode is that I don't know if it was Orwell's favorite book, but Mom was his favorite author. And so I was like, why don't I choose a book that Orwell liked?
Just kind of thinking through other things. I'm just looking through our episode list here, right? I suppose The Goldfinch, ultimately, right? Like, the character in that, I think, finds a path. But certainly in The Goldfinch, it feels like that character has kind of, like, found himself.
Right.
And it's, you know, very kind of, I think it, you don't spend much time in that, and it's just kind of a sense of a direction more so than an outcome, right? We talked about Gilead by Marilynne Robinson. You know, that character, I think, is in a place of contentment and meaning.
Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi.
That's a strange choice, but that works, yeah.
I guess anything 19th century, right? Like,
yeah.
Pretty much, you know, it's just the nature of the form then, right? Almost anything 19th century.
Maybe not Mayor of Casterbridge.
No, not Mayor of Casterbridge.
But those are often with the they're not escaping the system. They're finding they're finding their place in the system.
Right.
Right. So like the systems, modern literature, it seems, is not necessarily about, you know, we're not as interested in, you know, what's his name in Great Expectations, Pip. Thanks. You know, that's a story of social climbing, and that's still, you know, stories that we tell today. But I think we're today really interested in how the systems themselves oppress us. And so it's not finding a new place within the system. It's escaping the system and, or breaking the system.
Well, and I suppose that also, like, in theory at least, and maybe not every novel we've talked about actually bears this out, but in theory you have to have conflict to make a story interesting. And so the period in which someone has, you know, solved their problems, found contentment, that's going to be the period when conflict ends. So it will appear just briefly, passingly at the end of the novel.
Right.
Yeah.
I think Ballard is very interesting in this way, right? Because, like, pretty much every Ballard novel ends with the protagonist entirely embracing the world in which they have found themselves, right? But, I mean, it's generally some kind of grotesque, horrific, dystopian thing that they are, like, reaching a point of not just acceptance of, but kind of ecstatic embrace of. But, I mean, I don't know that that's really... I don't think Ballard is trying to, like, meaningfully set a guideline for how to live in the world as it presents itself. I mean, I fucking hope not.
It strikes me that there's always a cost. There's a cost to the main character, to the like, it's not a simple win.
The fact that we've gotten this digressed about a lot of other novels, and I know that I asked this question, right? But, like, I liked Perfection. I thought it was a very interesting read. I thought it worked well as a critique of what it's critiquing. Is the fact that we've drifted this far afield symptomatic of perhaps it not being as complicated or as enigmatic as some people seem to receive it as?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's exactly as long as it needs to be.
Yeah, I mean.
It's really, I mean, it one of your questions is about them as characters, and I think that that's pretty... The answer to that is they're not really characters, right? It's told from a kind of a philosophical distance,
yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. They're
very passive.
Yeah, they're weird. We're watching a simulation unfold, right? And observing what is happening to sort of develop a deeper idea of what's going on. And it's not a character study in any way, and not complex, but it is very efficient and really, I think, digestible.
Sure.
And good, you know, it's just good.
Yeah. Solid novel. Absolutely. You know,
as to why, you know, one of my questions was about why it's received the attention and why it's resonated with people the way that it has. I don't know if that's, I mean, that's probably not even slightly puzzling, right? It's as you said, it's digestible, it's efficient. It does, I think, identify an issue that resonates probably with a lot of It identifies an issue that probably resonates with a lot of the people that would be reading it. You know, it's very catered toward, like, an audience of a kind of person who wants to see their own life critiqued and their own values critiqued. We all probably think of ourselves as people who, like, are somewhat connected to the world of the type of people that live in this novel, but a little bit above it, right? Mm. That we're a little bit wiser and deeper than all the Toms and Annas of the world. And probably, like, you know, all the people who read this are people who like to think of themselves as a little bit wiser and deeper, sure, than the Toms and Annas.
Yeah, I mean, Patrick, I'm interested because you said that you like this novel. Is it because it is so focused and does it feel to you just like a clear critique? Like, it's just it's not
I don't know that that's why I liked it, But it does seem like a clear, open critique of modern digital 21st century life. I was ambivalent about the distant voice, and like at first was thinking, well, I don't necessarily like this distant voice. There's no dialogue. There's no like description as it happens. Like it's all told. Well, it's not all told in future tense, but you know, it's all, they would do this, they would do that, you know.
Right. It's very rarely a description of a specific scene, and more often kind of a cycle of behavior.
It's like a summary of a general type of event, which I wasn't sure at first that I liked that. I was thinking more traditionally, but then I thought, well, doesn't that, like, the choice to use this kind of distant voice, doesn't that say something? Isn't the form of that part of the critique itself? So, you know, I'm not going to be like, you know, this is the greatest thing ever, but I did think it was like intellectually stimulating while I was listening to it the whole time. I was, you know, I was like, this is intriguing. Like these kind of little bugs moving around about their little their little bug concerns, you know. So that was kind of a neat position that the author put me in. So solid book.
Do you think that either one of you will ever read it again?
No,
don't think so.
It's kind of the archetype in a way, as much as anything that we've ever talked about on the podcast almost. You know, I talk a lot about, and Chris, you to a lesser extent talk a lot about, like the sense that when you read a book and you feel like you connected with everything happening the whole time, paradoxically that makes it less, maybe it's not a paradox, but you know, something like, I like, at the moment that I'm speaking, I'm sitting at a desk that has a copy of The Golem on it by Gustav Meyrink, which is an utterly inexplicable novel with almost no conventional meaning that I've read four times, right? And these are like, it's hard for me in terms of like transparency of theme and event, it's hard for me to think of two novels that sit at like a greater kind of opposite pole than The Golem and Perfection. And I think you could certainly argue that Perfection probably has, to the extent that any literature has like social value, right? Or like redeeming usefulness, probably you could argue that Perfection is about as close to like a socially utilitarian tool as literary fiction can be while still keeping its artistic integrity, right? But ultimately, like, I love The Golem in a way that I don't love this.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading Cosmopolis about the same time for the fourth time, maybe, and it didn't help. It didn't help Perfection at all. I'm probably cool on Perfection a little bit. I think it's I think it's very good, and that's and it did lead me to it was I'll say this, it was worth it just to have the personal sort of like key in lock sort of realization or like epiphany for me regarding authenticity, what I talked about before, which is that like this question of whether authenticity existed before authenticity and living an authentic life and all of the questions that we have about authenticity, like I do in my work, we talk about authentic learning and then we kind of like groan because there's a sneakiness to that metric that like, ultimately it almost sort of, even as you sort of pursue it, it sort of conceals itself or morphs constantly to kind of like to get away from you. And just this idea of a kind of globally mediated image archive of all of these places and cultures, and the certain sort of strata of society that is economically and socially able to sort of disengage from where they come from and sort of just kind of blow across the, you know, world like a bunch of dandelion seeds. And then them feeding back into that archive their images of their lives distributed across the globe, sort of feeding this engine of what it means to authentically belong to or connect to or be assimilated by or give to a place, a people, a culture, a society. And that, you know, there's an original sin there, which is like the image itself that it becomes the rubric by which you sort of like measure your connection. And actually, like, that's not a viable path. Like, it doesn't work. Like, you have to be broken in some way. You have to, something has to be rent open inside of you. You have to be forcibly disconnected from your past and turned over and over in a washing machine and then find yourself, you know, confused in a new place. There's something there that I deeply appreciate this book for, even if I'm mostly cool on the experience of it.
That seems like a good stopping point. A nice blessing to send it off with. Patrick, what's our next book?
The Journal of the Plague Year by Daniel Defoe is what I want to read. Super neat old novel.
Ooh, that is an old ass novel. Ooh.
Yeah, yeah. Early 1700s. I've read a couple other Defoe novels too, Robinson Crusoe and Moll Flanders, but they're not, I know those are like Robinson Crusoe's like a classic, but it's, you know, it's ultimately like a morality tale for like Christianity and Lockean economics. Whereas Journal of the Plague Year is like strikingly interesting in its formal structure. So, yeah, super cool.
Excellent. Well, love those public domain books that you can get for free online. Save me $20.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's just thinking.
Sure, yeah. That's an upside.
All right. Well, yeah. Listeners, we'll see you in a couple weeks for Journal of the Plague Year by Daniel Defoe. Thank you much for your time, gentlemen. Hope you have a good rest of your day.
Thanks, you guys.